Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are putting our feet up in February in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Yes, that's right, it was quite the euphoric night at the Amex last Thursday with our late win against Marseille, seeing us top our Europa League group and fast track ourselves into the last 16. However, it was very much of a case of after the Lord Mayor's show on Sunday, as we put in a performance that we had seldom seen under Roberto De Zerbi, that saw us go down 2-0 to Arsenal and also lose our 32-game scoring streak. However, we do have a chance to put that performance behind us quickly as we face Thursday night football once more, which is something our hosts, Crystal Palace, have yet to experience. In other news, we have seen Jean-Paul Van Hecker put pen to paper on a new contract that ties him to the club until 2027, but we've also had the news that we'll have to wait a little bit longer to see Julio and Ciso again, with him now not due back until February. So joining me today as we look back upon the week and look forward to Thursday night is, of course, Alan Wares. And we're delighted to welcome back a man who would have seen our win against Marseille with perhaps a different eye. It's the Guardian's Ed Ahrens. Welcome back, Ed. Lovely to see you. You've been a busy boy.
I have, yeah. Good to be here. Nice to see you guys again. It was a great night. I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. It was a classic, you know, late win, deserved win, and yeah. Means a lot as well, I think, you know, for Brighton.
It meant an awful lot. Actually, Al, I mean, after the game, we were chatting, and you said how they talk about the great European night to Anfield, exactly, and you said you never really quite got it, and you said, I get it now.
Yeah, you have Clive Tilsley honking about it every single time Liverpool sneak a 1-0 win against some minnows from, I don't know, from Monaco or from... from some
Azerbaijan,
fifth division Italian club, but yeah, once you get that place rocking, once the Amex is probably to a lot of people a little bit of a library. It's not as bad as the Emirates, but to some people, I think that we're getting a little bit spoiled now. Sometimes, or we have been, with the quality of football that Roberto De Zerbi is serving up to us, and there's been a couple of times we're all guilty of it, I think, of kind of expecting to see a little bit of a show. So, of course, you know, we're seeing us now into uncharted waters here, and the decent performance that the team put in and kept going and going and going. Yeah, and then the 88th minute winner, and the place just lifts off. So when the Amex does take off, it really does take off. And yes, I now get it when they talk about European nights. And the real tragedy is that given the culture that we have of sticking around and having a beer afterwards and then going into town and having a couple more beers. And listen, it was so busy at the Grand Central. Myself and Andy Bass got back there. It was so busy, they couldn't find the twacker. I mean, that's how bad it was. We ended up with tequila, which is horrible. So, I don't know.
That's a good question there, actually, there, Al. This is... perhaps a very Brighton thing, but I mean, do you actually know what tuacca is?
I don't actually know. It's like an interesting drink, though.
It's a brandy liqueur flavored with vanilla and orange, and you have it as a shot. It's very sweet, very sickly. My partner, who's very delicious. My partner, who's from elsewhere, not around these parts, finds it absolutely revolting, absolutely minging. On the other hand, absolutely love it. Knowing full well that probably after the second, maybe third one, and I'm not being a lightweight here, hangovers are guaranteed.
Yeah, sounds like it'll be a heavy one.
Moving back to the football then, Ed, you've been fortunate enough to like be on this journey with us for a large part of it. I mean, you said you witnessed the first game against Ajax. You went to Marseille. And you saw the new more of the group at the Amex on Thursday as well. It's been quite something, isn't it?
Yeah, it really has. It's great to have been part of seen it from the start and through to the end. I only went to three games in total, and obviously three of the games that I didn't go to, you ended up winning, and that's when you. But I think you turned the corner at half time in Marseille, because it looked, you know, that it was 2-0 down. You were 2-0 down. not especially struggling. I think, you know, it was kind of a normal Brighton performance, but you've just been hit by two goals. And it looks that, you know, defensive vulnerabilities has been, you know, something that a consistency this season, I think, it's to be fair.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it wasn't looking great at that point, but to come back from that position to actually win the group, you know, is an amazing achievement. It's not to be sniffed at, it really isn't. You know, I know Ajax aren't in their greatest pedigree at the moment, but you beat them twice home and away. And to win in Greece as well, I think that shouldn't be underestimated, especially obviously Ajax were a decent team because they won at the Amex. It was a great night. And I think, you know, just talking about the stadium, you know, you've been there for what, since 2011, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's just about building those memories up, isn't it? It's similar with the Emirates, I think, because of the first few years that, for Arsenal, there was no atmosphere, and then it's, you know, building up those nights and those memories and those traditions at that stadium, and it just becomes more and more and more. Now you've got that European pedigree, it's gonna, you know, it really helps. And I think it was interesting what the Zerbi said, it was his best moment, you know. Sure. I think it was his best one, or one of his best moments, anyway. But
certainly, as the Brighton manager,
yeah, that's what he meant, as Brighton manager. And, you know, like, I think he realizes that, you know, the importance of doing something like that on the continental stage and into the last 16 as well, which is just, you know, there's a real chance of getting a long way in that competition now, isn't there? You know, whoever you get in the last 16,
yeah. I mean, I do still find it very galling that your reward for failure in one competition is to be relegated into a competition you've got a better chance of winning. It's the same as if we got into the Conference League.
It does work quite well in that they have to play the second place teams, don't they? So it's a bit of a sort of, you know, that you do get something for winning. You get a lot for winning the group, actually, don't you? It's really important these days.
Yeah, the round of 32 and the round of 16 are both seeded. So we're one of the seeded sides when it comes to the round of 16, meaning that draw that we've just seen... we will be playing one of those teams, one of those 32 that's there. And that includes the possibility of having Marseille again, which would actually be a real downer, a real sickener, because you think, well, hang on, we've got Feyenoord, we've got AC Milan, we've got Galatasaray. Actually, we don't want Galatasaray.
You don't want Galatasaray, and you know why we don't want Galatasaray.
Is there a particular reason why Brighton, they are just a difficult place to go? I mean,
one of your old brews.
There we go, yeah. Yeah, that would be one of them. It's not just it. They're a bit of a strange team. I watched them quite a bit in the Champions League. They're a bit of a strange team, aren't they? Just like a lot of superstars.
Yes.
Flung together. And
the Expendables, I believe, have been known as.
Yeah. No, that would be interesting, though, wouldn't it? A reunion with Mr.
No, it wouldn't be interesting.
Listen, AD, if it's all right with you, I just want to take stock here for a second. Because, like I say, when the draw came out, what was that? The end of September, we're all... end of, August, something like that. We were all very excited. Oh, my God, Marseille. Oh, my God, Ajax. Oh, my God, Ajax. But it's not even that. It's, oh, my God, we're here. Here we are, Ickle Brighton, who, let's face it, 2 years ago, or even probably at the beginning, I'll tell you what, probably this time last year, just before the World Cup, at what point would anyone have said, right, we're getting into the Europa League? There's an outside chance. There's a sniff. Let's dream. Let's go for it. Let's see what happens. And here we are, fast forward another year onto, you know, to Christmas 2023. Especially as Ed said, after those first game and a half, where we were just a little bit beasted by Ajax and we were absolutely hopeless in the first half against Marseille. Turn it round, and almost like it was a wave of wands, turn it round. It wasn't even a sort of slow, gradual thing. It was like, bang, they just found their niche. For us, in our first ever year in Europe, to face three fairly heavyweight European teams and top the group, ironically, keeping clean sheets as we go, we've got to take stock on that a little bit and just think, yeah, it's great. Yeah, here we are, living the moment. But I think, you know, once we get into Christmas and we sort of like down tools from football a little bit and have a little bit of a think, you think this is actually an astonishing achievement in its own right. Even if we then make a complete pig's ear of our last 16 match, this is actually an astonishing achievement for Brighton and Hove Albion. And hey, into March, we're still in Europe. I mean, and on the back of, say, for instance, the film that Matt Lorenzo did, the albeit the the rough cut version that we saw of the history, the story since 97. On the back of that, you think the leaps we're still making, even the treading water bit, even playing against Arsenal, getting beaten by them, but still treading water, we're still a top 10 side and we've managed to maintain it on the back of what? Just doing our stuff. And it actually is a bit of a head scratcher. It's so difficult to put into words how you feel. You just, I suppose, every Brighton fan who's going to listen to this is actually just going to say, well, sometimes words aren't enough or words aren't actually relevant here. Just go with your feeling, because at the moment, and we may, this may crash and burn tomorrow. It could go on to the next level. We don't know. But, you know, enjoy it. And I'm sure we all are, because at the moment, it's absolutely amazing. What a way to go into Christmas, into the next round of the Europa League. Looking forward to facing, hopefully, one of the European giants.
Yeah, I mean, Ed, though, I mean, it's very true that the momentum that we've been building in this competition, we're going to lose a little bit with the break between now and March.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think De Zerbi, because of the way things went in the group, I think he kind of prioritised it quite a bit, didn't he, in the league. He was really, he's made a lot of changes this season, hasn't he, from match to match.
Well, we've had to because of the injuries.
Had to because of injuries and just the number of games. But I just get the feeling that I think the priority for him this, you know, first half of the season was to make sure he got through in the Europa League and be in a decent position to, you know, get in the top six, potentially higher, you know, if things go really well. But yeah, similar to position to last season, and, you know, both objectives have been achieved, haven't they, really?
Mm.
You know, it's not been straightforward. It's not, you know, you have the defensive issues we've mentioned. But it's a real credit to him to get that squad, you know, the number of players that have been, you know, churning in and out, changing all the time. At the start of the season, I think that was a bit of a problem. I think the players have got used to that a bit more now, haven't they? That, you know, it's not the, like last season, you knew the 11 pretty much every week, didn't you?
But yeah,
this year it's different, and that's what it's got to be like when you're playing in Europe.
Well, I think we're actually going to see a little bit more stability between now and then anyway.
Yeah,
because the games aren't kind of quiet. So
well,
even over Christmas, we're hardly playing.
Now he can, you know, really, you know, focus on the league and try and get into contention for, I mean, top five looks quite difficult to do, doesn't it now? They're probably a bit too far away because there's a bit of a gap. But sixth place is definitely on for, you know, and there's a lot of teams in the mix for that.
But for a club of our stature to have achieved sixth place last season and then to go into Europe as an unknown quantity, let alone as an extra thing. I mean, like West Ham have been there before. You know, Villa have been there before. This is our first time. So for us to go into that as an unknown quantity and work out how on earth it is you're going to tread water. And I still harken back. I think Stephen Grant on here about 3 or 4 weeks ago was absolutely brilliant and perfect. And he said, this is a season of consolidation. Obviously, seventh is the target, although I think that there's an extra Champions League space up for grabs, so it might be as low as eight.
We might need to win it to do it because of the coefficient issues now, because we've had two teams finish bottom of their Champions League group, so that may change.
Yeah, we don't.
Well, yeah, times it by 10, throw the numbers up in the air, see how they land, the coefficient, and then, you know, stick a fried egg around it, and let's face it, it's a load of twaddle. They just make it up so that they can get more English, Italian, German and Spanish teams in.
Yeah, Ed.
But I was going to say this, I mean, all that they've achieved this season, you got to remember, you know, who they lost in the summer. They lost their two main midfielders. And, you know, like they have replaced them, but with quite a few different players rather than two.
Yeah.
And it's been interesting to see how he's managed that, like, you know, the transition. Because, like, yeah, that's a good point. It's a consolidating season, but at the same time, you know, you've got this amazing opportunity, and you're not wasting it, which is great to see as well. But I wonder what they're going to do in January if, you know, potentially
more kids.
You know, there's obviously some money. There's some money. Yeah, I think it's probably right, but there is some money there. They bought in Baleba, obviously,
to replace. Yeah, I think there's a Romanian fellow that's student.
Yeah, I mean, Adrian Mazilu.
Apparently, Boca Juniors are saying we're going to sign another one of their kids. So, you know, this rate, we're going to lose most of our players to the under-18s. It's a tricky one. And the point I was making is that to have achieved sixth place, which is by far and away our best ever finish last season, to take on Europe and with a load of injuries. And as you said, Ed, I defy any football club that had Caicedo and McAllister as their centre midfield engine, and to lose them both within the space of 6 weeks,
yeah,
and hilarious. Think that they can carry on as they were. I defy any club to...
Yeah, it's incredible, but also the squad is just, it seems to have a lot of depth, obviously not at left back, which is the big issue, isn't it? But
really, left back, right back, right wing.
But the whole squad seems to be, especially, and I've noticed, you know, up front, there's so many options, aren't there, depending on how he wants to do it. Adingra has added a lot this season, hasn't he? Really just gives him another...
Yeah,
great option, and he's a goal scorer as well, isn't he? So,
and we're about to lose him.
Really positive. Yeah, we're going to talk about that later, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the game. We're not going to go into it massively in depth, but I mean, we came into it. We knew what the score was going to be. Like, win, we go through and straight through to the last 16. Lose or draw, we still qualify for the runners-up. And we didn't have it all our own way. And there were certainly warning signs when Marseille hit the bar early doors.
Bit lucky. But, you know, it's one of those where... I think that given the way that the European... It's not fate, it's not lucky, it's just one of those things. But it's almost written in the stars that, you know, if we're going to do as well as we are in Europe and not concede and what have you, then... Sorry, all your shots are not going to go in. They're going. Anything that gets deflected is going to go, you know, off the post, off the keeper's backside. It's going to go, you know, into Van Hecker's, you know, frowns. It's going to be cleared by Lewis Dunk. It's not going in. So
yeah, it was like the Paul Parker one, wasn't it, against West Germany? It loops up massively, but and then. Yeah. Like you say, just those margins, isn't it?
But it is. Yeah.
I thought Brighton were generally, you know, just it was one of those games they created had a lot of the ball, and it's just they just slowly imposed themselves on Marseille, and it was like they ground them down, and the chances started coming towards the end, and it was like, are they going to take one of these now?
Yeah. But one player, Al, that you particularly wanted to talk about, and you gave him man of the match on Thursday, was Billy Gilmour.
I'm not going to do that. And we're not going to finish for 500 miles today because it's Christmas. No, that's a fella who, I mean, I was about to say he's grown into his role, but he still looks like someone who a big bully will actually nick the satchel off his back and stamp on his lunchbox. But a tenacious little tiger. He doesn't take any BS. When he was at Chelsea and he was getting his rave reviews when he was playing in European games for Chelsea then, and saying, oh, this is a real prospect, it's a real sort of talent here, he's done well, he's struggled a little bit in the Premier League, then in a way that sort of only Brighton and Chelsea can. Anything that goes from Brighton to Chelsea costs usually 8 or 9 figures. Anything that goes the other way is for Tuppence Halfpenny, drawn by Steptoe and Sons, horse and cow. And we have actually got the better deal for it. So he still can be a little bit hit and miss, but there are games where when he is boss, he is boss. And those two megs that he did that the club has since put out there, even I, as a gnarly, red-nosed, old, miserable git, when he did that little sort of delay meg, which set Mitoma on his way, even I sort of went, it was an involuntary, whoa! And it was absolutely brilliant. That's that kind of and you want that. You need, well, any De Zerbi player needs that kind of confidence.
Ed, obviously you would have seen Billy at Chelsea. Obviously he had that spell with Norwich as well on loan, which clearly did not work at all. Took him a while to get into the Albion team. Last year was obviously there was a few things going on off the pitch which would have affected that as well. But this season he's seen an opportunity with Caicedo and McAllister going, and he's grabbed it with both hands.
Yeah, absolutely. He's always been a very highly rated player. I remember when he was at Chelsea, there was a lot of fans who really didn't want him to leave because he had a couple of good appearances in the end.
Champions League winner.
Yeah, and it's taken him a bit of time to settle in, but I think that's just. His position is really tough, isn't it? It's playing that position going to a new club, it's really difficult to hit the ground running, I think. Especially, you know, he was up over first season, he was up against with Caicedo there. Difficult to establish himself, I think. But now he's very, I mean, he's perfect for De Zerbi, the way that De Zerbi wants to play within the transition. He's smooths the ball.
The thing about having McAllister and Caicedo last season, especially, and having De Zerbi for three quarters of a season, is that Gilmore could do a lot of his learning, a lot of his education, almost off the pitch, mostly on the training ground. Because there's an interesting interview that he did with TNT Sports straight after the game on Thursday, where they talked about what De Zerbi wants of him. And they said that he said that during the close season, he said that De Zerbi kept on and on at him to make him better, to do this, to do that. Bang, bang, bang. He'd keep going. He wouldn't leave him alone. He was relentless. And he said, I used to come away from some of the training sessions nearly in tears. What does he want from me? But he is that sort of character that says, no, you're not going to defeat me. Okay, if this is what you want from me, this is what I'm going to do. And I think that if that's probably what the best managers do. They know when to use the carrot. They know when to use the stick. And they I think probably also a lot of them can see the potential in any given player. And I think that clearly De Zerbi sees something a lot more in Gilmore than possibly he was actually offering at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, he's had some good performances for Scotland as well. He's become a big part of Steve Clarke's team, you know, over the last few years, their renaissance. Him and John McGinn from Villa, absolutely fantastic together. And they like I said, he's just the perfect player in that position for De Zerbi, to like on the transition. Possibly better in a way than Caicedo, because Caicedo, for all his attributes, his passing was probably his worst, or one of his worst skills, wasn't it? You know, he did, you know, that's being picky, but Gilmore, that's his best attribute, isn't it? That is his number one thing. Amazing passer.
Okay. Well,
it's interesting I just wanted to say about who's been playing the rotation of those two midfielders as well, because Gross has played there a bit. Daoud's been in and out. Baleba's obviously not had much of an impact yet, but he's like being blooded a little bit, isn't he? So he's obviously, I don't think he, it was, who do you think, I mean, you guys probably know a lot better than me because you watch them Brighton every week, but who is the first choice to at the moment?
If you're asking that as a direct question, my preferred two is Gilmore and Gross. But yes, fully aware of the fact that Gross is so much more of an Inspector Gadget type player. He is one player who fits so many different roles. I can see him going in goal one day.
Is it either Swiss Army knife of a player?
Mm. Is that what I mean? What did I say? Inspector Gadget.
I mean, it's Gross in an A and other, generally speaking. I mean, you've got Lallana, who's been coming in and out, but he's only ever been playing 45 minutes. Actually, on Sunday, actually played more than 45 minutes, which was incredibly rare. Obviously, you've got James Milner, who can play there as well. We can talk about him playing at left back against fast wingers, which is something we shouldn't. there is a lot of, Baleba was brought in with next season in mind. I don't think Caicedo going wasn't a part of the original plan. We were hoping to have him for another year, but then when Chelsea offered the stupid money, we can't really say no to that. And
offered it first.
Yeah, and Baleba was brought in and fast tracked. So,
but this is the point I think that needs to be made about the whole consolidation thing is that. Yeah, and I think that actually it's going to be very difficult for anyone in world football, let alone a bottom six resource club in the Premier League. It's going to be very difficult for anyone in world football to replace McAllister and Caicedo. So, yes, we've got someone who offers something slightly different. But if you want someone with that quality, it may be that we can actually get someone in. We may have to pay silly money for it. But you know full well that to lose two players of such high quality, like I say, I'll say it again, it's very difficult for even the likes of Barcelona or Real Madrid, if they had players that good, to replace them would be nigh on impossible. And for us, with our
budget,
with our budget and our attraction, we can go so far and probably higher than we have done ever in our history, but still we wouldn't be competing with the likes of Real Madrid and Barcelona for a player. So we have to go for the the next tier below. And
well, you've got Boss Clever, haven't you, basically? So yeah. Baleba is the guy, isn't he, basically, in that role?
He's been blooded for it. I mean, you have to remember, Caicedo took a long time to bed in. I remember watching the kids.
And he was always there. Everybody was talking about Bissouma, you know, when Bissouma left, it was Caicedo stepping in. But that's the succession plan that they have. And it's not just in those positions. It's not just in that position, is it? It's in every position.
And I mean, whoever it is.
Someone in mind for the future.
Whoever the Albion have their eye on it already. They know who they want to go for. Whether they can get that person, but they know already who it is they want to go for.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just thinking about another player, just an example where it doesn't work out because you know everyone knows about their successes. But Gokeres, who's at Sporting Lisbon now,
yes,
you know he was a project player for Brighton, wasn't he? They bought him at a youngish age.
Yeah,
never got the chance in the end, but now look, you know he obviously they were right because he's doing really well, but they were wrong to not give him a shot, maybe. But it's just timing and whatever. But just shows you that their net is so wide, they're picking up these players, even if they're not getting a chance.
I mean, with Victor, he was getting chances, but he was just getting impatient because he wanted to be playing now, and he wasn't prepared to wait, and that's why he went. I mean, I think we would have liked to kept hold of him for a bit longer, really. But and he would have got his opportunity a bit more. But he did play. He didn't play quite a few games for us, actually.
He ultimately, so. I think, he got better, and then he plateaued. And it wasn't until he dropped down a level for him to get his confidence back, and then to go from Coventry to Napoli, and then to
Sporting.
You know,
yeah. I think the strikers often it takes a bit of time, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know, young strikers lose a bit of confidence.
Okay. Well, let's talk about strikers then before we move on. Because, I mean, and we won the game in the 88th minute and it was a fabulous goal from João Pedro. And, I mean, we've all probably seen it. But if you are going to look for one particular highlight on the reel of this one, I do urge you to find out Danny's last video, which was just sensational.
Oh, yeah. He's behind the goal line, probably about, I don't know, 10 yards over from the goal itself. Gets a clear angle from the shot and the goal, and then he just sort of so calmly turns the camera around to basically limbs in the north stand. How he hasn't actually just leapt in there himself, I don't know it. For someone who's not sort of on the Albion's books, I think they're just sort of letting him in. That is absolutely wonderful.
It's sensational. And it was such a moment. And like I said, the sheer eruption, the joy, what it meant to everybody. And it's just something that we'll just carry with us forever. And it's just, you know.
We don't have to win another game to actually think, well, actually, for me so far, De Zerbi might disagree, Tony Bloom might disagree, Paul Barber disagree. I think that we've achieved our bare minimum that we need for to say that this Europa League campaign was a success. We didn't just eke through. We got through in the end of the fifth game.
Absolutely. I'd say it was a massive success for Roy. You know, just getting through would have been a success, but to win in such a way as well, it was brilliant, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, as a Crystal Palace fan, you know, there was an element of envy. And likewise, I was going to say, I went to West Ham's Conference League victory in Prague in May. And that's, you know, I mean, Brighton have got in the Europa League, which is even better. But for Palace fans, I'm sure that even getting in the Conference League and playing in the group stages would be a massive achievement. So to get through to the Europa League last 16 is massive. You know, so...
Hey, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. And of course we have a wonderful shirt of the week given to us from Old Football Shirts this week. And Ed, wonderful, can you have a go at describing this? I think it's a beauty. Al doesn't like it.
I hate it.
Ed, you're muted.
Describing it.
Sorry. Yeah. How can I describe it? Well, it's a sort of 70s... early 80s Adidas number with a red and grey sort of strange pattern, really. You can't really describe it in any way, that pattern, can you? But I'm trying to work out what
it is. Nice point. Sorry, while Ed is mulling this over, quickly, AD, if you can't describe a football shirt, I think just by its own nature, it's rubbish. Sorry,
I mean, most shirts have stripes, or you know, or some have hoops, not many.
Yeah,
or red or blue or just one colour, but this has got, it's red at the bottom and the top with a bit of grey, a lot of grey in the middle and around the sort of badge, and it's sort of, I don't know what, it's just...
I mean, it looks kind of like something that Andre Agassi would wear more than a footballer, but it is like, I mean, when I first saw it, before I saw who the team was, I mean, I actually thought, is that a Swiss international shirt? Because that's the kind of vibe I'm getting off it. But yeah, it's a red Adidas shirt, classic trefoil Adidas. There's a badge with a red lion on it.
And is it Scottish team?
It is not Scottish.
Okay, so I mean, I'm just going to quickly describe the badge. It's basically, it's kind of an upright lion that you get on a lot of coats of arms. In the closest way I'd describe the lion is the one that you have on the Middlesbrough badge. But the weird thing is, and the badge itself is shield shaped. And it's blue and white horizontal stripes across it. And I think someone has been playing with Photoshop to rub out the name of the club. So if it's, because when you said Scottish Ed, I thought, there's something in that. Because the first team that sprang to mind was that this is a away shirt for someone like Greenock Morton, who I know to wear blue and white hoops. Above and beyond that, one, I'm not 100% sure about the club. In fact, I'm not even 1% sure about the club. But because of the style of the Adidas logo, this says to me that this is at least 30 years old. So one, my guess for the year is 1991. As for the club, I have absolutely, because sometimes we're helped out by a sponsor and there's no sponsor on it. So
that could be a clue that there's no sponsor on it. Perhaps it isn't a club.
Yeah, I think.
Ah.
Oh, that's so interesting.
I think it might be a nation then.
Well, I know it is. Well, you
know. In that case, given that, well, I was about to say Albania, but that's got a double-headed eagle. An upright lion, I would therefore say Cameroon.
This is not Cameroon.
That's definitely not Cameroon.
Do you want to have a guess, Ed?
Oh, I don't know. Is it in Europe?
Is in Europe, yeah.
Austria.
Actually, I could see that could very well be an Austrian kit, actually, but it's not. It's I'll put you out of the misery. This is the 1993-94 home shirt of the permanently optimistic international team of Luxembourg. They are nicknamed Die Roten Löwen, or if you prefer it, the Red Lions. The Luxembourg Football Federation was formed in 1908 and they became FIFA affiliated in 1910. And their home ground is Stade de Luxembourg, which has a capacity of 9,386. The record for the most caps is held by Mario Mutsch with 102 caps between 2005 and 2019. He spent most of his club career playing in Switzerland with the likes of Aarau, Metz and St. Gallen. The all-time top scorer is Gerson Rodriguez, who has 59 caps and 20 goals to his name so far. He is currently officially on loan at Sivasspor in Turkey from his parent club, Dynamo Kyiv. Football links between the UK and Luxembourg then. Current player Daniel Sinai played for Norwich, Huddersfield and Wigan between 2020 and the summer just gone. He's at St. Pauli currently. And the current defender Maxime Chadeau began his professional career in Sheffield United in 2007. He moves on after a handful again. He's been in and around Europe. But he's currently had 165 appearances with MLS side New York City. And current centre-half, Ones Mahmutović, was with Middlesbrough between 2017 and 2020. But played very few games. He's at CSKA Sofia. Right now, links to the Albion then. He's uncovered a couple, but they are somewhat ambiguous. Luxembourg's biggest ever victory was a 6-0 win against Afghanistan, which was played in July 1948 at...
The Goldstone Ground.
At the Goldstone Ground.
Olympics.
And current goalkeeper Anthony Morris played 63 times for the Red Lions. He's the number one at USG, which is a very tenuous link. But there we go. So thank you for that. And of course, you can see that and over 130,000 other shirts over oldfootballshirts.com, including some of Ed Aaron's side, Mr. Perns.
Can I just point out that all those names you were reading out there of the alumni for Luxembourg, you made it sound like Eurovision, in as much as so many people from so many different countries have represented Luxembourg at Eurovision. And I think it's the same for the national team. I mean, how many Central Europeans did you name in that lot? It's a Don't answer it. But yeah, there was and I was astonished when you said the leading scorer's got 20 goals. I didn't think they scored that many.
And you didn't mention the Thiel brothers as well, who are the you're actually quite good. They're doing really well at the moment, Luxembourg.
They nearly qualified, didn't they? Aren't they in the playoffs?
I think they might be, yeah. They've got Vincent Thiel and Sebastian Thiel, whose dad was a player. And another one, Olivier Thiel as well, plays in Turkey. Their dad was a player. But yeah, I know they're particularly good red generation. They've sort of, punching above their weight.
It seems quite, I think of Luxembourg and I think of them losing 9-0 at Wembley with Luka Blisic scoring a hat-trick, but that's just because I'm old.
There's no easy games in football anymore, AD.
Not anymore. We'll skirt over our rare off day at the Emirates on Sunday. I mean, there are some highlights to pick out of it actually, which was the fact that Lewis Dunk was absolutely insanely magnificent in this game.
He was the nuts, wasn't he?
He quite literally was. He got one cleanly in the header, wasn't it?
Defensive.
It was a great header. There was a shot that actually landed right in the meat and two veg, which then we followed up 30 seconds later with a clearance off the line. And yeah, I think even reading on social media, the Arsenal fans were saying, yeah, that could have been 6-0 but for Lewis Dunk. So
it must have still been, you know, really painful, that 30 seconds later, mustn't it? You think, I was thinking that when I watched the highlights, you know, that sort of thing, it takes a good 5 minutes. Anyone that's happened to, it takes a good 5 minutes. Before you're feeling normal again. And he did that 30 seconds later.
The swelling helped get in the way of a few things. It was a game where we were terrible, and that's something that we haven't said for very, very
long. Now you're sounding like a Match of the Day pundit here by saying we were terrible. Can you actually not acknowledge that actually Arsenal were pretty good?
But this is the balance as well.
I've got that here.
You know, Arsenal, contrast, they'd already qualified for Champions League as Greens, isn't they? And contrast, you know, that's what you've got to take in this way it is now. If you're in Europe, you can't have both. Well, you can try it, but you've got to try for one, you know, prioritize one, and then hope that, you know, the second one doesn't go so badly. But it was just a bridge too far, wasn't it? Arsenal were prime for that game, and
yeah, I mean, it's been such a long time since I've seen us so comprehensively outplayed. I mean, Arsenal were great. I mean, Declan Rice turns out he's actually quite good, Al.
Can the real Declan Rice please stand up, because that wasn't him. I think also Arsenal had just had enough of us beasting them for the past three or four games. So
a different side with him, though. They're much, much more solid. I don't think they're maybe as like off the cuff as they were last year, but he's added a lot to them, definitely.
We got outplayed when we could very nearly have got out of there with a point if Pascal had put that chance away.
I thought you were skirting over this.
That's it.
All right, okay. Consider it skirted.
Okay, well let's skirt to this to the skirmish we're going to have on Thursday night in South London, Ed. Obviously, Palace go into this on the back of a brilliant result at Manchester City at the weekend. I'm still trying to work out what the hell City were doing with their advertising hoardings when Palace were about to take a penalty. Have you seen this?
No, what happened? Well, I know that I've noticed that they're absolutely massive, their advertising.
Yeah, they are massive. But it was basically whoever their sponsor was, it was Crystal Palace colours going around the stadium.
I saw that the sky was blue and red before they come back.
It was quite something. What that is?
No, I mean, it was an amazing result for Palace, because I think, you know, especially with the issues they've had with injury and. It was very clever from Roy Hodgson. You got to give him some credit for that, because you know, he just kept them in the game. He had Eze on the bench, ready to come on for the last 10, basically, and if they were still in a position to have a go. And even when they were 2-1 down, he didn't really go for the equaliser straight away. They just sat back a little bit more, waited. Then he brought on Eze when, you know, they had to go for it, and they got the reward. And it was a classic, like, sort of Roy Hodgson's a result in that situation.
As much as we're having fun this season in a sort of, you know, breakthrough, another breakthrough season, tell us about, in your opinion, the state of play at Selhurst Park.
Well, it's been a very frustrating season for Palace, I think, just because mainly because of the injuries and, you know, the sort of early promise of having Eze and Elise in the same team and, you know, potentially having a good season, because the first team is pretty strong. But the injuries have just, turned things sour quite quickly. And I think actually the biggest issue has been the home performances being really, really poor. They've won one game at home in the Premier League all season, and it's sort of, it culminated in that Bournemouth defeat when, you know, everybody expected them to steamroll the Bournemouth, and they were soundly beaten. And there's a lot of pressure on Roy, because, you know, it's kind of Palace is the same, or in the same, they haven't moved on, and if you compare them to Brighton,
it's,
you know, chalk and cheese, really, isn't it? Although, saying that, you know, on their day, they show you that they, against Liverpool and City, they're a match for any team, really. As I said, the first team is pretty strong, so should be a good game.
So is it?
Okay, well, let's go on.
Is it then in that case a fact that what you feel is, like you say, the first 11 is strong, but then once you sort of like start having to get into the replacements, that the quality of the next 11, for want of a term, or the ones next off the cab rank aren't as high or aren't quite as good as the first 11.
Yeah, I mean, if you just to compare with Brighton, and we're talking about succession plans and things like that, at Palace, it's not. Yeah. There's nowhere near the organisation that there is at Brighton, where they're thinking 2-3 years ahead. You know, just for an example, let's take Zahar. So his replacement was on paper anyway. Francia, this Brazilian boy, who looks actually, from what we saw on the weekend, it was the first time we've seen him in any serious action, looks pretty talented, but he's only played about, you know, four sub appearances, I think, and hasn't been given much of a chance. And Roy Hodgson was really critical of him and some of the other younger players, and it's just sort of the joined up thinking doesn't seem to be there at Palace if you're looking really critical from the outside. But also there has been a bit of a lack of investment. Although they have, you know, obviously signed Eze and Elise to new contracts, which is absolutely massive for Palace, because especially Elise was as good as gone, really, at the start of the season. But I think the fans would like to see a bit more investment in the team. But the problem, as we were mentioning just before we started recording, is the stadium, really, and they're trying to get the stand built, which is supposedly progressing. They've got planning permission and stuff, but
at least we know what it looks like. It's basically a replica of the Amex West stand, but
it's the same designers as Liverpool's main stand. That's just 3-0
KSS,
and it's a sort of mini version. It does look very impressive, but you know, it was announced in 2017, so they were going to do it.
That was what I was going to ask you. Let's compare. Palace with Brighton, because like you said, we've got forward thinking chairman, an owner who's got a plan, a direction of travel, from not just on the pitch but off the pitch, with the infrastructure, with the stadium, with the training ground, and we've seen this with Palace. There's a lot of talk and a lot of bluster about this new, they were looking at building this new stadium, and then there was a problem with the having too many councils involved and no one knowing what was going on.
No, I think, to be fair to Steve Parish, he has been an amazing chairman for Palace, and it's unprecedented. I know Brighton's success is unprecedented, and, you know, and you've done a lot better than, you know, gone to a much higher level. But Palace is, you know, more than a decade in the top flight, has never been done before. But, yeah, so the issue with the ground goes, you know, and it's actually interesting because the Crystal Palace, if you know the area, the Crystal Palace Athletic Stadium, which in the last week or two has just been given a new lease of life, supposedly. And that was the idea. Parish really wanted to go back to there. That's where the club played briefly, I think, a long time ago. But that was the problem with the councils. There's too many councils involved in there. So they were stuck with the original Selhurst Park site. And then that's, you know,
is there really nowhere else in the vicinity
estate in London is difficult, isn't it? And there's not really.
I mean, that's the kind of perverse thing. I've got a reasonable ken on the area, and so yes, I know that the Crystal Palace Stadium, slap bang in the middle of Crystal Palace Park or Sydenham Hill Park, whatever it is you want to call it, just literally down the hill from what's left of the old Crystal Palace that was in Hyde Park. And yeah, there's public transport links, there's railway stations all the way around the park. But yeah, I think as the northwest corner of the park is the confluence of five London boroughs, not all of whom are actually sort of quite that sort of enamoured on having a Premier League football club in the middle of the park, because, you know, politics, because neighbours, and basically, you know, look up the problems that we had, and you probably sort of, it's going to get exacerbated five times over for Palace. So is it a case really that you're stuck at Selhurst Park and you just make the best of it?
Sadly, that ship sailed a long time ago. I remember talking to Parrish about that, and it was around sort of, just think about when you moved into your stadium, around that sort of it time, 2011. And that was his big dream to go to the National Athletic Stadium, you know, the old Crystal Palace. But yeah, that's long gone, and you know, he's been focused on getting the main stand rebuilt for the, you know, I think it's the 1920s. It's from,
I think that stad is the original one that went in, isn't it? You're looking to replace.
I think it's 100 years at Selhurst Park this year as well.
The Arthur Waite is replacing as well.
It all does, really, but it's a step by step process. And this Brighton have really stolen the march, and by having this, the stadium is so big, for, you know, and he had to go through hell not having it home and everything. So fair play, but you know, that's given Brighton the basis. And similar, I think, always think West Ham as well. If you look at West Ham now, they're able to sign like people, you know, 40, 50 million pound players because, and get into Europe because they've got this, you know, regular.
Signed 40 or 50,000 million players because West Ham will put a release clause into their contract, unlike Brighton.
But you know, I mean, Brighton have done amazingly to catch it. But yeah, West Ham are taking advantage of being in London as well, aren't they? And that's, you know, I think Palace fans are envious looking at them, thinking maybe that.
West Ham got given a stadium and then the money from.
Well, yeah.
The bowling ground, so they you know, and that was a stadium. West Ham's ground is a stadium that we, the taxpayer, built.
And it's given them a massive leg up, hasn't it? Let's be honest. And Brighton did it the hard way in financing themselves.
Absolutely, the bank crash.
The thing is, I don't know what you think about the location of the stadium, but it's probably quite annoying, isn't it? You mentioned the trains and stuff, but that's the balance again, isn't it? Like Palace, the stadium's in the community. And, you know, that's the good thing about it. We have that atmosphere. And you do the Amex as well. But, like, it's just the new stadium.
It's not like walking to the Goldster.
No. Although I think that it's actually... I was actually looking this up the other day because, you know, there's the idea of the club wants to build a bespoke women's stadium. And the council wants to work with them. And I sort of, like, half jokingly said... Well, perhaps they could buy back for the same £7 million that we were fleeced for the old Goldstone site, buy that back and build up, because the footprint and the size is perfectly big enough. We don't need a huge stadium there. But then I realised, actually, there's some new plans that are going in for housing on that site. So,
but yeah, you have a similar issue in Brighton, and that's probably... I don't know much of the history of the Amex and everything, but imagine that's why they went out there to Belmont, because it was...
There was nothing in the city centre.
It's similar pricing, isn't it?
Brentford managed to do it. They managed to find somewhere to squeeze that in. So, you know...
Yeah, that's an unbelievable feat, isn't it? It's right next to the floor.
Okay. Well, obviously, next time we're on it, we'll talk a lot more about the Crystal Palace, and hopefully talking about our 41st win over Palace, which we're ahead. We're 40 to 37 at the moment, 30 draws.
Is that what it is? I was going to ask, actually. Yeah, okay.
And
one other thing, AD, about that is that the bragging rights we have is right. This is actually kind of interesting, given the number of times we played each other. We've doubled Crystal Palace three times, and Palace have done it once. And I'm thinking, in the number of seasons that we've played each other, you thought that there had been actually a lot more. Just the rule of averages says it would be. But no, we've only done the double over Palace three times, and Palace have only done it once.
Just trying to see when you won Selhurst Park last time.
It was Anthony Knockhart putting one in on the last
was
minute.
I was on holiday, I remember it now. Yeah,
it was Glenn Murray's 100th goal for Brighton.
We haven't got an awful lot of time left. But
I was going to say, there's been a lot of late goals, hasn't there? Sorry to interrupt. There's been a lot of late goals in recent games.
That's the thing about playing Palaces is that, you know, for all the fact that De Zerbi gets all the credit for the lovely football he plays, and Roy, is sort of struggling a little bit. And like I say, the Palace first 11, that's pretty good. But then sort of after that, you need to raise the bar a little bit. Every time Brighton play Palace, it's almost as if, and we're back to this Ajax thing, of Brighton play the occasion rather than the game. Because, you know, it's not as though Palace play a spoiling game, far from it. It's just like, I think it was last season. I think we won, but Palace played some really, really good football, and we were hanging on a bit at the end.
Yeah.
You won one. Neither side really plays a really good game in that fixture, do they?
Yeah, that's true.
No, it should be good. I think Palace at least have got a couple of players back now, so there should be a bit of a be able to put our side that's not full of defenders.
Okay, well, we haven't got an awful lot of time left there, but I mean, just as a lot of you may know, as well as being an excellent writer for The Guardian, Ed is also the host of the Made in Africa podcast, and you're a bit of an expert on African football. Obviously, we've got the African Cup of Nations coming up very, very shortly. We're losing Simon Adingra for that tournament. A lot of other Premier League clubs are going to be losing a lot of players, so. Just give us a quick thoughts on the tournament. Who's the favourites and who are going to be the big stars?
I think Morocco are the big favourites. You know, everyone remembers from the World Cup.
Yeah,
but it's kind of the usual suspects of the last few years. Senegal always really strong. Egypt have been doing well, obviously with Salah, and Cameroon always good. Ivory Coast are the hosts, but I don't think they've got so many good players. Ivory Coast, but they're not in a great generation at the moment, particularly, but yeah, you can never rule them as the hosts have got always have a strong.
Yeah, this is the bit, Ed, where you're meant to say that the Ivory Coast are rubbish; they're going to be knocked out really quickly, and we'll get Simon Adingra back after a week. That would be great.
Well, the thing is, unfortunately, it's quite hard to get knocked out of the AFCON in the first round, so because it's one of those 2014 tournaments, and you might have to wait a bit.
Best team, and then there's the coefficient, and then there's the flip a coin, and then there's the, you know, what did VAR say, and you know,
It should be a good. It should be a good tournament, though. It's interesting to see how many players end up. Most of them will go, but I think there's a few that are going to be under a lot of pressure to not go, and like come up with an injury. You know,
have you got a Palace who's likely to go?
Just Ayew. From Ghana and I'm trying to think now off the top of my head. That's pretty much it, I think. Ayew and Schlupp isn't.
We're losing two and would have lost three but for injury. So we're losing, as you say, Adingra. I think we might lose Baliba. It depends if he's and but for injury would have lost Tarek Lamptey as well.
I mean, there's certain. It's not too bad for Brighton, but Adingra is going to be a big miss, isn't he? You know, he gives you that extra.
Playing pretty much playing every minute of every game for us. So amongst all the rotation that we've actually had, he has been.
It's interesting. He's not quite got the hype of Mitoma last season.
He's actually playing every minute.
Yeah, Adingra's not quite hit the heights of Mitoma yet. He's still a work in progress. I mean, he was on loan in Belgium last year, and. You can see that there's a raw talent there that, you know, the approach play is pretty good. You just got to learn crossing it and the final ball and things like that. But there's something slightly exciting about him.
Yeah, he's given you
just some Mitoma is unfair.
He's given you, Mitoma is one style of player. Solly Marsh is another style of winger, isn't he? And it's good to have, and he's a bit of a, you know, he's a bit of a maverick, I suppose. He can, he just knocks things off the cuff. And you need, that's maybe something that was missing on the wings for Brighton before that, so he's
absolutely.
But again, another, you know, it's been planned, isn't it? They earmarked this season for him to be in the
place,
and it's worked out.
I mean, obviously that pathway that he had. I mean, you can't compare that to Carew because obviously he went through exactly the same pathway. He came over here, we put him with USG for a season, had a successful season with USG, came over here, and he set the Premier League on fire last season and continues to do so this year, although he hasn't quite hit the heights of last year as yet. No, but for Simon, exactly the same. He was on loan with USG last season, had a great season, played in Europe, and and obviously he's come over here. And he's been, you know, we've very, very much enjoyed watching him, and we're, you know, obviously it puts it's a shop window, the AFCON, isn't it? I mean, we're not looking to sell anyone, but is there any players there that we might not have heard of that could set the world on fire?
I was just going to say about Adingra, he might be in the same team as Zaha, mightn't he?
Interesting.
That would be amusing. Yeah, there's a guy Metz who I was just checking out, this Lamine Kamara, who's he just won that African Young Player of the Year. He's 19, plays for Senegal.
Right.
Yeah, watch out for him.
Has he been linked with anyone, or?
There's quite a few clubs looking at him, but no one. I think it might be a bit early for him to come yet, but you never know. I mean, he's sort of player that Brighton would sign and be in the team in 2 years. Or this guy as well, Amara Diouf, who's, I think he's only just turned 16, but he's already, I don't think he'll be at the AFCON, but he has already played for the senior Senegal team.
Wow.
He's in Senegal still. So I think that's the market that Brighton, I think, I'm sure that they're, and, you know, some of the clubs that are cutting edge of scouting and stuff are looking at direct deals with African clubs as well, because...
Well, that's the kind of interesting thing. We've picked up African players, but only once they've arrived in Europe.
So you paid a premium for... Well, just think about Baleba, yeah. I can't remember what the cost was, but it was only about 18 months before that he went from Cameroon, I think, to Lille. And so the turnaround of, like, a million euros of initial fee, and then they turned him over for whatever it was.
It was for about 30. I mean, yeah. Part of that was the fact that they thought that we were desperate, which we weren't particularly. But I mean, it was obviously a player that we wanted.
No, exactly,
but when you just sell a player for 115 million, all of a sudden everybody's price goes up, right?
But the difference is now Brighton can go, or any club in the Premier League can go and sign players from outside Europe when they're 18, which they couldn't do before. So it's a really, they can directly from African clubs, which is
just because we're in Europe.
No, it's because of Brexit. The rules have changed, haven't they?
Oh, I see.
You know, you can't sign European players under 18 anymore, but you can sign players from outside Europe so you can cut out them. Often with South American and African players, they go to another club in Europe first, and then Premier League teams buy them for more. Okay. Sorry.
So it's a gun to head. You're saying Morocco to win the AFCON?
I think they've got to be the big favourites. Yeah, but yeah, it should be a good tournament. Senegal are going to be hard to beat though.
Absolutely. I think that actually, if we're talking about money that we get in, we don't necessarily spend it on players. We spend it on things like fan zones, which means we can sort of drink even more beer.
That's a good idea.
You know, 450,000 pints a season is not enough. We need to drink more.
Well, it is Christmas, Al. So, and that is actually all we've got time for this year. So, for myself and Al, a very Merry Christmas to everybody. Thank you so much to Ed Aarons for joining us today. Hopefully, you're not after Thursday night, you can start to enjoy your Christmas, but not before.
Oh, and thanks a lot.
It's not too much. Obviously, you know, it's been a fun year here on at Raw Towers, hasn't it, Al?
It's been brilliant. And thank you to everyone who's listened in. Thank you to everyone who's contributed. Thank you to everyone who's been on the show and offered their opinion. We love to hear them. And thank you most of all to Roberto De Zerbi and Brighton and Hove Albion for giving us probably the best calendar year in the club's history.
Thank you for listening. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on the podcast, in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Merry Christmas, one and all. Here's Dominic.
Hey, jingity-jing, it's Dominic the Donkey, jingity-jing, the Italian Christmas donkey, la, 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 la. Santa's got a little friend, his name is Dominic, the cutest little donkey, you'll never see him kick. When Santa visits his paisans with Dominic, he'll be, because the reindeer cannot climb the hills of Italy. Hey, jingity-jing, it's Dominic the donkey, jingity-jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La, 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 la,
bells around his feet and presents on the sled. Hey, look at the Mayor's Derby on top of Dominic's head. A pair of shoes for Louis and a dress for Josephine. The label on the inside says they're made in Brooklyn. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the Donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La 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 la. Children sing and clap their hands and Dominic starts to dance. They talk Italian to him and he even understands. Cumbares and cumbares do they dance a darandel. When Santa Nicola comes to town and brings Ujucharilla. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La 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 la. La 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 di da.
Hey, Dominic, buon Natale. Eat on, eat on, eat on, eat on, eat on, eat on, eat on.